Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live.
Welcome to Simple Living Works, Episode 5. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host, presenting the conclusion of the award-winning program Break Forth into Joy, Beyond a Consumer Lifestyle, and a bit more on preparing for Christmas, New Year's, and Epiphany. To learn more about Simple Living Works, our mission, for example, please listen to our Getting Acquainted episodes, especially numbers 1 and 2. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. I'm glad you're with me. In the second part of Breaking Forth into Joy, we hear three bonus segments: Freedom and Possessions, Family and Children, and Taking Action. To hear the main program, listen to the previous episode, number 4.
Simple life ought to be described with words like celebrative, however you pronounce that, or Eucharistic living, instead of feeling that it's confined and a great poverty. Let's open it up into the fullness that it is. In the Old Testament, the prophet Hosea said, "You shall eat and eat and not be satisfied." That was a curse. It's this excess and this insatiable appetites. That's the unfree life. I think what we're talking about are words like more freeing, more celebrative, and more Eucharistic or thanksgiving. If you never know when you have enough, you never know when to say thanks. Proverbs says, "Give me neither poverty nor riches, but feed me with that which is needful for me, lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of my God, or lest I be rich and say, 'Who needs the Lord?'" I don't think there's freedom either in poverty or in too much. That's why we're talking about sufficiency. That's the freeing. You're not addicted to things, and you're not spending all of your time trying to find enough to live. There's nothing freeing about either of those. But our culture very easily sees there's no freedom in poverty, but we tend not to see that there's also no freedom in affluence that's gone overboard.
Some time ago, Jürgen Lissner, who was with the Lutheran World Federation, had 10 reasons for simplifying your lifestyle, and we've condensed them into 4 issues because it's easier for me to remember them. One is a faith issue. To me, that means that I need to trust that what Jesus said, that our needs will be met. And even when Jesus talked about how rich God's blessings are for us, he talked about the image of a bushel basket shaken down and overflowing. And I think our problem is that when our basket gets full, we go with an even bigger and bigger basket and say, "Well, God, you filled up this first little basket. Let's see what you can do with this bigger one." So we never know what enough is, and we have to decide that for ourselves. So the faith issue to me says I can trust that God is always going to supply my needs. The second issue is a freedom issue. It is not freeing to feel addicted to stuff. Ernst Becker said it very well when he said, "We drink or drug ourselves into oblivion, or we go shopping," which is the same thing. It is not freeing to have to always try to be accumulating more and more when we could be desiring less and less, and then realizing that you have to protect it or clean it or shine it or store it, all these other things that we don't like doing. The third reason is sharing and solidarity. I know that if I change my lifestyle, it's probably going to not change a lot in the world. But it gives me a sense that my brothers and sisters who have so much less than I do, that I am in solidarity with them. There is no reason why 6% of us in this country need to consume 30 to 35% of the world's resources. And the fourth reason is a witness. Again, it's what Peter said about being able to speak to the hope that is within you. I don't do that very well because my lifestyle looks like everybody else's. I wish that I could get to the point where my lifestyle wasn't one of poverty, but was one of sufficiency, and that I joyfully lived that way so that people came up and say, "Gosh, you don't have a lot of this world's goods," or, "Your car looks pretty crummy," or, "Why are you dressed in those clothes?" But I could give the reasons why I want to live more simply and why those things shouldn't be so important to us.
If you look at the person of Jesus and the way Jesus chose to live his life when he was here, the way he chose to interact with people and not possessions, that's our role model. And it's a good model. It's one that has my best interest in mind. It has the world's best interest in mind because Jesus loves us. So I can trust his lifestyle. I can trust his teachings to be good.
One of the reasons that I was brought into some of the simplicity changes after she led the way was because my son was born about 6 years ago, and he was born with a birth problem, a physical problem, and I had been used to having an older car or a toaster and just throwing it away and not fixing it and making do. And suddenly I had this little body that didn't quite work right, and we had to do therapy with him twice a day and to help it work right. And I learned something, that we need to do better with what we're given, have better stewardship with what we're given, and make do. And I was ready for more of the lifestyle changes then, I think. We had a realtor once who, as we moved into our new smaller house, was real blunt and said, "Why did you buy such a small house?" And we tried to explain about the reasons, wanting to downsize, and he said, "Well, my wife and I don't have any kids, and we bought this huge house with a $1 million loan, and was trying to impress us." And so I said, "Well, why did you buy such a big house?" And he said, "Because I can." And in those three words, he summarized what has made the American dream an American heresy, that people get as much as they can because they can. And one of the chapters in our book is called Because We Can, that we can downsize, we can live simpler lives. Why? Just because we can.
I've had a chance to just do some of any and everything that I wanted to do. But at the same time, that sense of fulfillment was not there. That the things, I mean, it turns into what Tracy Chapman talks about in her album, just mountains of things. They don't mean anything. And I think as soon as people get to that realization that things don't mean nothing, you can get on with your life and really make meaningful contributions in terms of interacting with other people, in terms of giving back to your community, to your neighborhood, to your government, in terms of really having a quality life with your family, instilling some type of values that don't depend on material things to make them real.
If we define the individual in relation to community, being in a community itself is job, is work, is fun. Whereas if you are individual, how do you keep yourself going? You better do something, otherwise you are lost, you are alone, your life becomes meaningless. I think the individualism of our community does affect the way we see ourselves. When I think of the older people in India, when they are not doing anything, they have retired, they don't have a job to do, they're sitting at home, but just being with other people is living, living fully, living abundantly. I think that perception of being with others itself as a way of defining yourself does help. If you are left alone as an individual, how do you look at yourself? You can look at yourself only in the things you do, not just being there.
I'm not being tied to a department store. I'm not having an intimate relationship with a department store or with a credit card company. I think maybe perhaps before that was like my God. It was where my power came from. My self-esteem came from things I had and the power. I have a $2,000 limit. I can use it. And I'm enough myself, and I don't have to have things and purchase things to have some kind of power. I'm more powerful just as my own person.
To try to live more simply is going to be in a direct collision course with our culture, because sufficiency as a justice lifestyle is not what the capitalistic system demands. If we can't have more needs so that we buy more things, our system isn't going to work. Someone that is very content reading, visiting with neighbors, sexually very happy, enjoys their family, and doesn't spend a dime, they're not going to be very good for the capitalistic system. So I think there is always the subtle push to consume and to consume and to consume more stuff. It doesn't feel weird to me as a Christian to be anti-materialistic. It feels weird to me in the society in which I am living. It's a very subtle seduction, and I think you feel very strange because you're out of step. You hear a different drummer, you want to go down a different path. And there is a subtle seduction of the American churches and of American Christians in general.
What I see going on in the culture was described by Thomas Merton when he left New York City and went to a Trappist monastery in Kentucky. He said, I'm going to leave the world of manufactured needs that are met with manufactured goods. I think that we have created what are essentially luxuries and made them into needs, so that we really do have our satisfaction and our well-being in consumerism, in materialism.
A quote from Schleiermacher, a German theologian, we don't lie in the bosom of the universe. We are running around. We need to lie in the bosom of the universe. There is fun in simply being in this universe. Isn't it fun just to be here, looking at these trees, these birds, the clouds, the sky? There is simple beauty in being. If we can recover that and not define ourselves by what I'm doing, what I'm achieving, there is fun and beauty in simply being a part of this universe, this beautiful universe.
Advertising probably works even better on children because they can't discern whether or not this is something they really need. And then you have children, you know, fighting over that. The disparity between have and have-nots is more evident in children when public schools are moving to wearing uniforms because children are fighting over Nike shoes or I think their self-esteem. They grow up and they realize they can't have all of those things. And I see our economy is shrinking. I can't provide for my family what my father hoped to provide for mine. So at some point I have to explain to children, you can't have everything that you see on television. You don't need everything you see on television.
Money was one of the big jumps that we made in the beginning. We cut working hours in half, which meant salary got cut in half, which meant we needed to make a house move. So it all kind of worked together. Right. Our kids were smaller when we first started out. And they had some questions. They wanted to know, why do we have to move? And so we had to talk about that. We had some kids come over to play that did not necessarily feel comfortable from our old neighborhood, come to our new neighborhood to play that didn't feel comfortable. And so that was uncomfortable for them. But after a couple years, just the other day, they said, you know, it's easier than it used to be. They don't care so much about some of the things that they'd felt pressured on before. And so I think in the end it's been good for them.
I remember our kids responding to having less money around the house, but our kids already were learning that we may have less money and can't keep up with the other families in purchasing clothing, for instance, with certain names on it. But I remember my daughter saying, but we have our dad back, and that made it worthwhile. There are a couple of schools of thought on television. One is to say that if you have cable and 49 channels, you can choose really good programming for your family, for your kids, etc. And we've opted the other way. We have two stations that we can get for free, and we choose not to have any others. And for us, that works very well because our kids are playing and learning on the computer, and they're making things, they write stories, they play with each other, and they interact better. And so we feel that time-wise and energy-wise and values-wise, it's a good idea not to have too much of that.
We treat TV as a treat. It's not something that's just always available. It's kind of like dessert. And we choose the programs that we want to watch together, and it can become a family event, which is good TV time versus bad TV time. One of the issues that seems to be everybody's issue is time management, not having enough time, wishing you had more family time. So one thing that we've done that's really been helpful is that we try to limit activities to two nights a week. And it's not that you always get two nights a week, but if it gets more than that, then the offending party is told. And that's been very helpful because we are busy on two nights, but the rest of the week belongs to us.
And if meaningful activities steal time from the family, we let it happen. There are times when there are emergencies or special needs, but then we don't feel bad about stealing the time back for us later.
The thing I find so amusing is that we tend to live our lives backwards from what we really believe. If we say family is a priority, then we need to give time to family. If we say a spouse is a priority or God is a priority, then we need to give time to God and let the boss be second or let other obligations be second. And we have that choice. It's like there's another voice telling us we can't give our time and our energies to the things that are really important to us, and we have some choices there. One of the gifts of simplicity is learning to laugh again. We found that when we were out of sync or out of pace that we quit laughing, and that's one of the danger signals that should go up. If people realize that laughter has disappeared out of their household or out of their life, that they need to do something about that.
My first year of college, when I went back, I was not fashionable. I was not a fashionable freshman because my father believed in the basics. So when he asked me what I wanted for Christmas, I said, "Dad, can I just have some new clothes?" And so he told me, he said, "Well, okay, we can think about that." But before we went to buy clothes, you know what he made me do? He says, "I want you to go in your room and take all your clothes out of your closet and hang it up right there." And I tell you, it seemed like it was a never-ending stream. You know, by the time I'd hung everything out there, he said, "Now, did I understand that you need some clothes?"
One of the things which is very different from my life as a kid in India, from a life of a kid in India now and U.S. now, is the number of toys we had. Literally, we had no toys. We made our own toys. I still remember as little boys, we would collect the fruit of the palmera tree, cut that into two halves, and put a rod in between, and use it as a little scooter to run around the streets. So there was, I think, we were doing much more creative stuff, making our own toys. That is something very different. I find an additional problem there, because I have to make decisions as to at what points my children would be adjusting themselves to this culture and be like everybody else. And what are the points at which they would keep their Indian culture? So when we have that kind of a struggle, when the children are trying to define themselves within a culture which is not theirs, they cannot afford to have too many things different from others. And one of the things very difficult to be different from others is the way you dress. So they are, in a sense, compelled to go for the kind of brand names which their friends and peers might wear. And at that point, we have to say, okay, we give in. We can't say none of us would wear these. So in a sense, we have given in at those points of consumerism, just to help the children to feel at home in a different culture which is not there.
For me, living in community means that I have learned what interdependence is all about. I think that's a very biblical concept. We're taught in this culture to be very independent, to look out for number one, to make sure that I get what I deserve. And when you live in community with other people, our community happens to live in the same general residential area. We don't all live in the same house. Some single adults live together in a house because they think it's less expensive, which it is, and they enjoy one another's company. But most of us live within a 5 or 6 block area, and it makes it possible to share newspapers, as one of my best friends does. She shares a newspaper with 2 other families. The 4 of us share 2 cars. We share magazine subscriptions. We share childcare. We have meals together. To live in community is very important for children. At least it was for our children. I can't imagine raising children now if there were not people of faith who shared the values that you share. There is too much going on around them, from the kind of tennis shoes and jeans and the kinds of games and hanging out at the mall, has become a national pastime for our youth. If you don't have a community of people around you who say, this doesn't have to be, we can get together in the evening and we can play games and we can do things together as a family and join with other people who share those values, I think that's how our children have to learn that they aren't just kooky all by themselves, that there are other weird people who are willing to step out and be weird with them.
Live simpler in the sense that, not to take away, I mean, we still have cars and we still have pets and we still go visit our relatives in the other states. Those are family foundation things. Simpler are like, and I'll just use it, and everybody talks about it in the magazines, you got the Nintendo and you got the three bikes and you got the several options of sailboat school, then you have kayaking school, and then you got those options. When you do those things, is that the real world, and are those the people that you deal with when you grow up and you have to live with, and when you're in the workforce and when you're in society? As a child, if I were to stay in front of the TV and be on Nintendo all the time, how am I going to be able to relate and be with the people in this planet and on right here in my own hometown? I wouldn't know how to talk to them. I couldn't just walk up to a neighborhood and start jamming with them because I wouldn't know how to speak their language.
We were all taught to be citizens of the global community. We were taught that there was no person that would ever be a stranger, that every person was our brother and sister, and we would afford them the same courtesy, the same affection that we would afford someone in our intimate nuclear family. And the wonderful part also that really was special for me personally was being around elders all the time. I was the youngest of five siblings. So I had a real opportunity to just leisurely be surrounded all the time by wisdom.
And the longer I live, the more I see we don't need much. And our children don't need any more than anybody else's children anywhere on this earth. And even though I'm put down in a setting with a country where I have a lot around me and I can consume a lot and I have a lot of material blessings and educational blessings, it's still for me an option of how much do I take and why do I take it.
Simplicity is probably our biggest peacemaking tool, and we don't realize it. The haves and the have-nots is a big war, at least in a lot of places it has already started, and I see it as getting bigger and bigger as the years progress. The haves and the have-nots, the ones who are fed and the ones who are not, the ones who have shelter and the ones who are not, the ones who are warm and the ones who are cold. God has some strong things to say about the highs and the lows in life. We're all God's children, and it doesn't seem right that some should live so much better than others.
I teach a course on images of Christ in different parts of the world. So we were discussing image of Christ as a liberator from oppression, liberator from want, from poverty. Immediately this question came, what shall I do? All the students felt that they were rich. I think they really came to a realization in a powerful manner that they were rich. So what shall the rich do? So these are questions they are struggling with. I told them that there are three things they could do. One is symbolic acts of working towards justice. They are not real acts that lead to justice, but symbolic. Giving up one meal, having a prayer vigil, these are all symbolic acts. Then there are small steps of the contributions you make, the sharing you do. That's the second level. There is a third level of what I would call systemic acts, structural acts, much more socio-political level of action which they can engage in as they go along to change the things that we find in our society. With regard to systemic change, it is very difficult to give answers right away, because it involves a lot more conversation and cooperation between peoples. So in a sense, what I'm teaching my students is once they recognize that there is a need for systemic change, they have to find ways in which they can engage in conversation with people both within the church and outside the church so that together we can work for change. Change in laws, perhaps, change in ways we relate to each other as nations, as communities. But these are acts which one cannot simply do by thinking, okay, let's do it. No, we need to engage in conversation. There's a lot of negotiation to be done, a lot of commitment to cooperate with each other.
Well, for many, many years, I didn't know how to go about helping other people. I was disturbed by the disparity between people that have money and the ones that don't, the rich and the poor, the black and the white, the differences in resources. So after many years, I read an article in 1983 by Tony Campolo, who said that if we are to follow Christ, then we must learn to sacrifice, to give, to share. And Christ himself set that great example. He had so little. In fact, he was homeless. But he shared what he had with others and taught others to do the same.
What I have been doing the last 6 years is to help people move from the paralysis of guilt. So I tell my students in my first class, it is very easy for me as a person from outside the United States, take just 5 minutes and paralyze you all with guilt. I can give you horror stories, that is enough. But that doesn't help. The one way to do that is that the kind of sin we are talking about, the kind of problem we are talking about, is not an individual problem. It is a problem which is linked to the whole community and the way we are organized in the world. The way we are organized in the world, socially, politically, economically, that's what determines this kind of unfair sharing of resources. So that means we cannot simply be changing individuals. We need to work together so that we can change the way we are organized in the world. But for that kind of activity, we need individuals who feel forgiven of their participation. So in that sense, I am really offering, as a person from outside the US, a certain assurance of forgiveness to people, so that will remove them from the guilt, but move them towards doing something. Not simply giving up one meal, but working towards structural, organizational change. I think people can never act if they are burdened by guilt. So to act, they need forgiveness.
There's a bigger issue here than just choosing to live a life so we feel better or we have less and have less to care for. That's still kind of a me message. And the real issue is that we choose to live that way so we can free up some resources that we didn't have available before. Some of those resources are time, but some of those resources are money. And it enables us to live more like the rest of the world lives.
In many ways, talking about simple life is a middle class luxury. Most of the world lives simply because they have no other choice. For some of us to say we want to simplify a little bit, that's a middle class luxury. There's also a violence in saying to poor people, you really don't want this. I mean, we've had it, but it's really no good. You try that in a poor neighborhood and you'll get a reaction, oh sure, great, now that you've had it and you're tired of it, we shouldn't want it. And there is every reason that they will want it, that poor people do want some of the stuff we've had. That doesn't take away from the reality that too much is still a curse, and that what we're talking about is a kind of sufficiency for everybody, not having everybody come up to the level of living that we're doing. The world cannot live the way we're living.
The world is getting smaller, and we need to learn how to get along better. And living more in sync with one another is a good place to start.
There are some benefits to buying at the discount places because you can buy 100 pounds of rice and you can buy enormous quantities of things, which is in one sense better stewardship of your money. You can buy more with what you have. On the other hand, there's the struggle of the small business person, especially in the small towns. And sometimes simplicity for us means that we allow people to afford something themselves as well. And so we struggle between supporting the local business and being able to do financially a responsible job. It's a struggle still for us. To live a simpler life ourselves, we need to be careful not to steal simplicity from other people. That means recycling. It means pre-cycling, making good decisions in the first place so you don't also have to recycle later. And that way you live a life that's not only simpler for yourself, but it makes it possible for future generations to have that as well.
I think people who volunteer feel a sense of ownership in their community, and they get involved and they feel like they can affect some positive change. It's easy to sit back and just say, oh, why bother? Nothing ever changes. And I don't think that's true. I think people, when they come together and they work for a common good, unfortunately, in most nonprofits or in the community, we're trying to provide more and more service with less and less dollars. And if we don't start pulling together with people, that's the only way we're going to affect a change.
We're obligated to share our excesses. If we have extra income that isn't vital to our basic needs, then I feel as a Christian that we are obligated to share what we have with others. That's in some ways a radical thought, because the average Christian probably gives about 2 to 3% of their income. But we feel that we are called on to make a much greater sacrifice and not to spend too much money on ourselves. So we feel a deep obligation and a privilege to be able to help other people who have so little. No place to stay, no food to eat, no way to get from one place to the other, no income, sometimes mentally ill, and they have nobody to fall back on. So we feel an obligation to share what we have with others best we can.
When Alan retired in 88, we decided as a family to go to Africa to learn about hunger firsthand and to see if American Family could make a difference. We didn't go with any special program to push mainly to learn. And while we were there, my mother died. And my mother had been mentally ill for many, many years. And looking at the village and looking at the babies' lives that died from simple diseases like diarrhea and malaria, when my mother died, we decided to go ahead and give her estate a total of $30,000 to the women of the village if they could come up with a program that would save the lives of their children. So somewhere in this village in a country called Burkina Faso, country most people never heard of, is this nutritional center built in honor of my mother that actually saves lives of the children. One of the things that we promised these people when we came back to the United States that we would do, these people very poor, very hardworking, and very honest, is that we would tell their story with justice in all that we do. And it transformed us. And ever since then, what we decided to do is to volunteer full-time working with the poor here, working with the homeless. And not because it's just the right thing to do, but I think we reach highest when we stoop lowest to help somebody up. That we are inspired and nurtured and meet Jesus in those that have so little. Why? Because they're closer to God than maybe a lot of us are, because we have things that get in the way where they don't. They have their faith and their strength, and they take each day as it's the beginning of a new day and the last day of their life, and that's how they live it. So it's a lot to be inspired by and learn from working with the poorest of the poor. I think that what we're all striving for is the kingdom of God. And the kingdom of God comes from within, not through consumerism. Once we discover the kingdom of God within us, then God helps us discover our neighbor. And once we discover our neighbor, we're able to go out and love and serve our neighbor. And that's what life's all about.
You've been listening to The Complete Break Forth into Joy Beyond a Consumer Lifestyle. It has a free study action guide when you're ready to use it personally with your family, at the church, or in your group. The links to the study action guide, as well as the video version, are in the show notes. Also in the show notes are links for some of the speakers, such as John and Mary Schramm and David Allen Sorensen and Barbara DeGroat Sorensen. The Sorensens wrote a series of simple living books, including Tis a Gift to Be Simple, 6 Weeks to a Simpler Lifestyle, Escaping the Family Time Trap, and numerous others. If you feel ambitious enough to have an alternative giving festival, you don't need to start from scratch. Guidelines from experienced folks are in the show notes. Or you may want to add something to your existing fall festival. Plenty of ideas worth considering are given in the show notes at simplelivingworks.org. Click in window number 3. Alternative's legacy resource, called Voluntary Simplicity Study Action Guide, also deals primarily with celebrations. See the show notes for a link. Now, here's what you can find in Treasury of Celebrations for the first of the year. First, there's New Year's Day, which includes a New Year's Eve watch night service and reviewing the old year with friends. Also on January 1st is Emancipation Day, including a table talk for Emancipation Day. Then on January 6th comes Epiphany and an article called Light for the Dark Days. And I'll tell you a secret. Most of the audio programs I'm going to tell you about are available by themselves. Some are also in text version, and some also in video versions. Most of them are coming to you neatly wrapped in the series that begins next episode. I'm telling you this so that if you want to use one or more of them by themselves with your family or in your congregation, no problem. The links to them on the website are given in the show notes. I'll go through them slowly. Take a few deep breaths and let the possibilities sink in. First, Let Jesus Come, Let Santa Go, a workshop for an alternate Christmas celebration. Unplug the Christmas Machine, the workshop leader's guide to this classic in both text and audio. The Celebration Revolution of Alexander Scrooge, a retro version of Dickens' Christmas Carol. Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Carols with Justice Sing-Along, a collection of well-known carols with new words in text, audio, and video. What Does Jesus Want for Christmas? A pageant that includes Carols with Justice. Let's Get Off the Christmas Roller Coaster, an audio short about influencing others to simplify. Whose Birthday Is It Anyway? 5 of the 24 print editions of Alternative's best-known resource have audio versions. Here are some other text resources that you'll find in the show notes. 15 Christmas packets of useful materials. An assortment of Advent Christmas calendars. The Christmas Campaign Kit. Christmas anthologies of short classics to read alone or aloud. An index of the Advent Christmas articles on our website. Advent Christmas chapters in 2 collections. First, Spirit of Simplicity, Quotes and Art for Simpler Living and Global Justice. And also in Worship Alternatives. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to podcast@simplelivingworks.org. On our Facebook page, or on the Simple Living Works blog. All these addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org, in window number 3. If you'd like to contribute to the 2013 online edition of Whose Birthday Is It Anyway, go to our show notes, and we have some submission guidelines there. I hope you'll send us an article or some art. Beginning in episode 6, I'll present the 6-part radio adaptation of the well-known Whose Birthday Is It Anyway? I hope you'll listen to the entire series, though each part is self-contained. Each part contains an audio short, such as The Story of Jason, What Does Jesus Want for Christmas, Let's Get Off the Christmas Roller Coaster, plus real-life reflections on the Advent Christmas season. We'll have numerous guests. Now, you may wonder, why make such a big deal about Christmas? Well, our mission is to equip people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. All three of those fit together, and they especially fit together at Christmas time when consumerism is at its peak, when we need reminders both to be charitable instead of spending so much on ourselves, and to challenge the systems that make charity necessary, and to celebrate in simple ways that focus on relationships instead of stuff. Well, time to wrap up episode number 5 of Simple Living Works podcast. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. We'd love to get to know you as a subscriber to this podcast and to the blogs we post new each week. Subscriptions are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Remember to like us on Facebook and urge your friends to do the same. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. Provide your email address, and we'll send you the monthly Simple Living Works e-newsletter. By the way, thanks to John Pitney for music on this show. Find details in the show notes. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share and Share Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage at simplelivingworks.org. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works Podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly.